Well, good morning. I think we can get started. Thank you for coming. My name is My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, and we're doing a series this week that I've explained a couple times as a repeat of one that I did a couple weeks ago, called Beyond Words: Wilderness Sojourns for People in Transition, starting from the key text for the theme this summer, Moses at the burning bush, receiving his call to lead Israel out of slavery and told, "Take off your shoes, the ground on which you stand is holy ground." We've been beginning there and shooting off in several directions. It's called Beyond Words. For those of you that weren't here on Monday, it's called Beyond Words because the way I understand the word for wilderness in the Hebrew language, it's a word that means somehow or another separated, among other things, from words and from things that we use to make meaning out of our lives. I've also built myself, for those of you who are new to the village in the last day or so, I've built myself as serving the village as not Walt. Walt Bowman was to have been here this week and is unable due to his cancer diagnosis and illness. The hilarity this morning begins with a footnote to yesterday. My friend Bob Niedringhaus has a brief story about a forbidden thing.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt Fred yesterday, but when we were talking about dancing, I'm old enough to remember, I started college in 1960. I went to Luther College in Decatur, Iowa, and it was right at the time when dancing was an issue in our church colleges, and we were just starting to introduce dancing on campus. And my brother, on the other hand, was a senior at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, and he invited me up to go to class with him one time, and it was right at the end of their education, and the college professor was talking about some of the practical issues they were going to have to face when they got into their congregations, and he said one of them was going to be dancing. The way kids were dancing nowadays was going to be an issue, and then the professor said, actually, he said, "I don't think dancing is as big a problem as the automobile is." He said, I still haven't heard of anybody having sex on the dance floor. one of the seminarians raised his hand in the back of the room. He said, "You haven't been to Storm Lake, Iowa yet."
All right. Maybe we can find Storm Lake in the penitentiary. All right, well, the other alleged hilarity with which I will begin this morning is it has to do with the theme that I'll develop this morning. I think the title up there on the board is something like either a dessert in the desert or the diet with no name or something like that. So obviously we're going to be talking about the problem of food and provisions in the wilderness. And so I looked for some food humor. You know, you have to be careful with food humor. There isn't much of it anyway. But here, these are just a couple of lame efforts. Someone gave me a book that teaches a way to achieve inner peace. Among other things, it says, the way to achieve inner peace is to finish all the things you've started. So I looked around the house to see all the things I started and hadn't finished. And before leaving the house this morning, I finished off a bottle of red wine, some Tylenol with codeine, half a cheesecake, and a box of chocolates. You have no idea how good I feel. And then I ran into these. These are a few deep questions that maybe should somehow belong, if not in the Bible, at least in our theological tradition. If there is no God, who does pop up the next Kleenex in the box? So, And how do you know when it's time to tune your bagpipes? How much deeper would oceans be if sponges didn't live there? Now, this is a great Holden question. If it's true that we're here to serve others, what exactly are the others here for? And now, finally, the food ones. Why do buffalo wings taste like chicken? And what do chickens think we taste like? And finally, what was the best thing before sliced bread? All right, well, the wilderness is remembered two ways in the biblical tradition. Tomorrow we're going to see that in some parts of both the prophetic tradition and elsewhere, the wilderness is remembered as the best time God and Israel ever had together. Indeed, it was honeymoon. It was the idealized period when our relationship was young and everything was still pure. But the Pentateuch and several other looks at the wilderness period in the Bible discuss it as a terribly rocky time. Nothing but fighting and contentiousness, rebellion, and as we'll see, the beginning, or maybe not the beginning, but the perfecting of the litigious society. The trouble begins almost immediately when the Israelites, back already in Exodus 14, after leaving Egypt following the final plague, they come to the Red Sea and immediately they fall to accusations against Moses and against God for bringing them out into the wilderness, apparently to die. Why didn't you just let us live and be slaves instead of bringing us out here in the wilderness to die at the hands of the Egyptians who are fast approaching? And God saves them from the wilderness. But immediately after they cross the Red Sea on dry land, or the Reed Sea, however you understand it, and they celebrate with a song, which seems to have been Miriam's song, but had a little copyright problem with it, and it gets attributed to someone else. Immediately, they fall to complaining over problems related to water and food. And the whole rest of the story then becomes, in some ways, a story of fighting about what they don't have. So let's begin today by looking at Exodus 15, beginning at verse 22. What I really want to look at goes all the way to chapter 16, verse 36, and that's quite, or the end of 30 of 16. So that's quite a lot to try to read together. So we'll summarize. They set out from the Red Sea, and they go 3 days into the wilderness and find no water. When they came to Marah, they couldn't drink the water because it was bitter. That's why it was called Marah, which means bitter. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" What helps you understand maybe a slight joke, but maybe the level of seriousness of this problem, is that the word for complain there in verse 24 in Hebrew is a technical term for filing a lawsuit. At least by the time these stories are written, that's how this word was used. so that there's a little, maybe a little joke going on here, that the very first thing that happens in the desert is they sue. They sue the leaders because there's something the leaders forgot, like, what are we going to drink out here in the wilderness? Moses cries out to the Lord, and the Lord shows him a piece of wood, and he threw the wood in the water, and the water became sweet. All right, that's good. This will get us through at least a little while. There the Lord made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he, and now here's a critical phrase for the whole rest of the story, all the way to the end of Deuteronomy. He put them to the test. One of the ways the entire wilderness story is going to be remembered is as a test. God constantly puts Israel to the test to see whether they will continue to follow the directions he gives them, whether they will continue to be faithful to him. But as we'll see in Deuteronomy, it's also remembered as the time when God put Israel to the test. God said, if you will listen carefully to the voice of the Lord, your God, and do what is right in his sight and give heed to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I won't bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. And they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the water. Now, as we were saying the other day, this is kind of hard to picture, given how many people we're talking about. Chapter 12, verse 37, says that they were 600,000, and some, not counting the women and children, and not counting the strangers who came up among them, and also not counting, says Exodus 12, 38, the enormous herds of livestock that they brought with them. So we're not just talking about 2 million or so people, we're talking about an undetermined amount of animals that they brought with them. So I don't know exactly what good 70 trees and a spring are going to do them. I have a hunch that the narrative actually pictures a smaller scene. But in any case, chapter 16 then begins the story that we're much more familiar with, about how God fed them in the wilderness. The whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elim and came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained, and there's that lawsuit word again. They said, if only we had died by the hand of the Lord in Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So by now you can see that their only memory of Egypt is, we ate so well. I mean, they forgot a lot. At least on the other side of the Red Sea, they still remembered, we might as well still be slaves. It'd be better than dying out here. But so soon they forgot what the price of all that free food was. It wasn't free food. They had that food at the price of slavery. And now all they can remember is, well, we used to eat just fine. So the Lord says to Moses in verse 4, I'm going to rain bread from heaven for you. And each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In this way I will test them. There's that phrase again, whether they will follow instructions or not. And then is the direction about having to pick up for 6 days, but not pick up any extra. I mean, it's scattered over the whole chapter here. Only on the sixth day do you pick up extra, because there won't be any on the Sabbath day. And so this is a way to learn that the seventh day is holy or different, and you don't pick up food for that on that day, but you pick it up ahead of time and so forth. In the evening, you get a different kind of provision. Every evening, quails come and cover the camp. And in the morning, there is a layer of dew around the camp, and when the layer of dew lifts, there on the surface of the wilderness was a fine flaky substance as fine as frost on the ground. I'm in verse 14, by the way. And when the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, and here's the name of the stuff. They said, "What is it?" Which in Hebrew is manhu, or man, as we say, manna. So the name of the stuff, manna, is Hebrew for what's that? What is it? Lots of people have tried to figure out a natural explanation for this. There are supposedly some secretions of some insects that are sometimes in certain places left like the dew on the ground, and it is edible. But if we really are talking about a couple million people, that's a lot of insect secretion. And I don't know how we are to imagine that there's daily supply of quails enough to feed 2.5 million people coming through every day. The point is not that we should try to figure out exactly what this bread is. It's just the right word to call it. What is it? Because the point is not where does, you know, where, what precisely is it made of? As we will eventually see, the answer to the question is, it is enough. But here we have the setup then for wilderness feeding. It's a one day at a time set of provisions with the Sabbath system built into it. Exodus 17 is another water story. From the wilderness of Sin, the whole congregation of the Israelites journeyed by stages as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. They quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water." Moses said, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water and complained against Moses. There's the lawsuit word again. "Why did you bring us out of Egypt? To kill us? And our children, and our livestock?" So Moses cries out to the people, "What should I do with this people? They're ready to stone me." The Lord said, "Go ahead, take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile. I'll be standing there in front of you on the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it so the people may drink." Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He called the place Massah and Meribah, which means testing and lawsuit, because the Israelites quarreled and tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So that's really what their question is. They judge whether God is with them or not by whether or not they have food and drink. And so the whole rest of the story in the wilderness becomes at least in part the story of living by this daily ration of manna and finding water as they needed it, and both of these things became troublesome. I'm sure you all remember why Moses didn't get to go into the promised land. There's that strange story about his having struck a rock twice at one point when God told him simply to strike the rock. That story is in Numbers 20, verses 1 to 13, and people always try to... That's worth turning to just for a moment. Let's look at that just for a moment. Numbers 20, verses 1 to 13. Again, the whole congregation gathers against Moses and Aaron, and the people quarreled with Moses. And again, in verse 3, they say, would that we had died in Egypt and all that. God tells Moses in verse 8, take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and your brother Aaron, and command the rock before their eyes to yield its water. Thus you shall bring water out of the rock for them, and you shall provide drink for the congregation and their livestock. So Moses took the staff from before the Lord, as he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered and assembled before the rock, and he said, listen, you rebels, shall we bring water for you from the rock? And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his staff, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and the livestock drank. Now, this is what you would expect Moses should do, right? This was the method in the previous time we saw this. You take the staff and you whack the rock and everybody drinks and it's all fine. But this time Moses strikes it, and he strikes it twice. So the Lord says to Moses, because you did not trust me to show my holiness before the eyes of the Israelites, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them. So, lots of people have written about exactly what was Moses' sin. And this was a matter of great concern to the ancient rabbis. What exactly did Moses do wrong? One theory is that he was only supposed to strike the rock once, but he struck it twice. Another is that he wasn't supposed to strike it at all. He was only supposed to command it this time. And that it was like a little game God was playing with Moses, and he was seeing if he would follow orders exactly and not remember precedent, like Mother May I, you know. You forgot to say May I. But the majority opinion, at least in the rabbinic tradition, pardon me, is that the real problem is when Moses says in verse 10, listen, you rebels, shall we bring you water out of the rock? And God's command, or God's explanation to Moses, that you did not trust me to show my holiness before the eyes of Israel, that the real sin was that Moses had begun to think it was about him and not about God, and that he wanted vindication, and he wanted to show the people that he could give them water. You want me to get you some water, or me and Aaron? All right, we'll get you water. When it was really about God. So Moses is being put to the test here too. Will Moses be able to remain just the servant, or will he finally get in the way and think he's more than just the servant? That's the rabbinic tradition. So water remains a problem all the way to the end, as does food. As long as you're pretty close to this, one of the funniest food stories is back in Numbers 11, just a little bit back from this water story. The story that ultimately results in God having Moses collect a group of elders to help him out. The people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes, and the Lord heard it, and the Lord's anger was kindled. The fire of the Lord burned against the people and consumed part of the camp. The people cried out to Moses. And then verse 4, the rabble among them had a strong craving, and the Israelites who wept again and said, and the Israelites also wept again and said, if only we had meat. We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. The whole grocery list. But now our strength is dried up and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. You know, and you can just imagine, you know, we're close to 40 years in now. And by 40 years of manna every day, you know, a whole generation, that's all they'd ever seen. They had baked manna and boiled manna and you know, manna a la king and manna on toast. And up here you'd have millet manna and manna loaf. And they were sick of it. And so that, you know, this becomes a not a story of miraculous provisions at all anymore, but a story of odious routine and everything the same. And yet, the story is remembered, you know, as a prototypical story of how you live dependently upon God. Flip for a moment, please, to Deuteronomy 8. Deuteronomy is Moses' farewell address to the people as they are about to enter the land without him, because he won't get to go in. And the entire thing is also in the form of a covenant between God and Israel, and Moses gives them this covenant that they are to keep, and this is part of the preamble. Verse 2, remember the long way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness in order to humble you, testing to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments. He humbled you by letting you hunger, then by feeding you with manna, with which neither you nor your ancestors were acquainted, in order to make you understand that one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. The clothes on your back did not wear out, and your feet did not swell these 40 years. And as we learned, well, it was last week in Vespers, Deanne Lagerquist was quoting Deuteronomy 29:5, not even your shoes wore out through all these 40 years. So, this was a great time for you because you have lacked nothing. And your feet didn't even swell up. Know then in your heart that as a parent disciplines a child, so the Lord your God disciplines you. Therefore, keep the commandments of the Lord, and so forth. So, that's how the wilderness ultimately is to be remembered. In the period between the end of the writing of the Hebrew Scriptures and the beginning of the Christian period and the rise of the New Testament literature, the wilderness began to become even began to become idealized even differently than the way the prophets understood it. And the giving of manna in the wilderness came to be understood as one of the signs of the Messianic age. There would come another day when we would receive the bread of the angels, and that was the name that they gave the manna in this later literature. And there would come a time again when we wouldn't need to till the ground and do all the things that we have to do to work for our food. We would simply walk outside in the morning and the food would be there. There's a children's book that makes fun of a notion like this that I wish I had with me. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? The story of Sunny with a Chance of Pink. What? Yeah, cloudy with a chance of meatballs. It rained food in this particular story in a community until the people finally got sick of it. But anyway, that's the messianic dream, that food would just appear. And we would have the bread of the angels again, and there would be no more lack of anything for anyone. That was one of the great messianic dreams. Which takes us to the way that the New Testament picks up this whole theme and story in the story of the sojourn of Jesus in the wilderness and his being put to the test. That's told very briefly in Mark's Gospel immediately after the baptism in chapter 1. But told in more detail in Matthew 4 and Luke 4. So what I'd like us to do next is to turn to Matthew chapter 4. as in Mark, Matthew and Luke have this happening immediately following Jesus' baptism. Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted. Here it's by the devil. But already, if you are connected to the traditions of the older literature, you can hear bells ringing. We're in the wilderness, and it's a time of testing. We know this story. And lo and behold, it lasts 40 days and 40 nights. 40 years it was for the Israelites. And Jesus was fasting, and afterwards was famished. So we got a hungry wilderness party, just like in the old story. The tempter comes and says to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." Let's just stop there. What kind of temptation is this? It's not a temptation to break a law. At least to my knowledge, there's nothing in Torah or anywhere else that says thou shalt not command stones to become bread. Thou shalt not change stones into other things. Or thou shalt not eat rocks. There's just no commandment that applies to this. So what's the problem with turning a few stones into bread? Well, some might say just listening to a suggestion from this source is a problem. But that doesn't quite hold either. By the way, one thing you should know is the language we have here for the character who's administering this test is fairly late language in the biblical tradition. It begins late in the Persian period when Israel picked up from the Persians a picture of how human beings are put to an ultimate test to see whether they will be on the side of, whether they were in their lifetime on the side of good or evil. And the person who administered the test as to your disposition was simply called prosecuting attorney, which in Hebrew is Shatan. So that's who Satan is, the prosecuting attorney. The person who puts you to the test and whose job it is to help determine who exactly are you. What side are you on? The devil, Diabolos, that's an overthrower. That's what that word means. Somebody whose job it is to knock you from your defenses. So that's what Jesus is up against. Somebody who's putting him to the test to find out exactly who he is. And we have to remember, he's being put to this test immediately after the voice from the heavens has said, "This is my son." And that's why the question is, well, if you are the Son of God, do this. Well, to make a long story short, because we got three of these things to get through, what the real test here is has to do with whether or not Jesus will fulfill the great human dream as Son of God to do what all the ancient literature says would happen when God finally came to put things right. Would Jesus initiate the great banquet that we know of, for example, from Isaiah 25, when God will finally wipe away all tears, and when God will set a feast of fat things and wine on the lees, well refined with enough leftovers to stretch for miles in the presence of God's people, the great messianic banquet? That's what the tempter wants. Come on, Jesus, if you are the Son of God, set the great feast for us. Because if you could change stones into bread, you could probably also change stones into oil, and you could change stones into pharmaceuticals, and you could change stones into iPods, and you could change stones into anything you want that people love to have, and that people need, and that people even like to have a little bit extra of. So that if you could change stones into bread, or if you would start changing stones into bread, you could solve maybe the world's greatest problem, and that is the lack of enough for everybody. And there would be no more hunger, there would be no more want, no one would ever again have to fight over stuff, no one would have to live without, everybody would have enough of everything, and the world would be fixed. That's the great human dream. May there be a goodly share on every table, everywhere. We pray that at my house. It's still a great human dream. So Jesus, just do it. Well, Jesus' response, and you'll recognize where it comes from. We just read this a moment ago in Deuteronomy 8. Jesus answered, well, one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. There's two critical pieces there. We'll come back to the second one, but one implication is, even if we had everything we wanted and then some, would that really be enough? Would we truly be satisfied? You know, how much is enough? Or is there really any such thing as enough? There's a lot of people in this world would say, I have enough, that I live like royalty even, perhaps. But I don't feel like I have enough. I'm still trying to save more. The devil took him to the holy city, placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it's written in Psalm 91, and if you can't believe the Bible, what can you believe? He will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone. There you go, Jesus. Do that for us. It's a couple ways to look at this, and I'm sure some of you have probed this deeply also. It's, you know, for one thing, it could be that we want Jesus to prove that all this God stuff and God's promises are real somehow. It's 430 feet from the pinnacle of the Jerusalem temple to the Kidron Valley below, by the estimates of those who have studied what the ancient temple must have looked like. So it's not quite like jumping off the Sears Tower, but hey, 430 feet's a pretty good leap. So what if somebody would, you know, jump from the Sears Tower or the Empire State Building, land on the street below, ta-da! Trust God. Would you do it? Would that work for you? Or if the sky would light up every night in neon and say, cool your jets, I'm really up here. Here's your sign for the day. Would that do it for you? Would your life be fixed? You'd be happy? I mean, I know what I would say at the Sears Tower. I would say, do that again. But Psalm 91, or texts like Isaiah 65, which is in the same pattern as Psalm 91, say that if you are one of God's people, if you trust God, nothing bad can happen to you. God's angels will see to it that you don't even bruise your foot if you fall. And Isaiah 65 promises that for those who trust God, there simply is a situation where no one dies young, where no one ever loses an infant. Parents don't ever have to bury children, and so forth. So I think what this temptation really is not just for us to get to watch Jesus leap from the temple and prove that he's powerful or magic or something. What we really want is for Jesus to jump from the temple to the Kidron Valley with us on his back. And what we really want for him to jump is the valley of the shadow of cancer, and the valley of the shadow of auto accident, and the valley of the shadow of all the other things that happen that make us grieve over a life ended too young, so that every one of us can die at 90 in our beds quietly with our grandchildren gathered round singing us to the other side with the old hymns. Wouldn't that fix the world if nobody had to die young and everybody got all their years? That's the great human dream. And all we have to do to see how fervently we still dream it is to listen to the projections of what pharmaceuticals and other things are going to do for us over the next couple decades. So Jesus, come on, do it. If you really are the Messiah, give us that gift. Jesus says, it's written, don't put the Lord your God to the test. That is, you know, trust God, even if it looks like God's promises from your perspective aren't kept. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor, which would be a high mountain indeed, given the way we look at the world. Luke simply says he took Jesus up. And he said, all these I will give you if you fall down and worship me. And Jesus simply says, away with you, for it's written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him. Well, what's this temptation about? This time, of course, we do have a problem. Probably Satan worship isn't the best thing to get mixed up in. There is a commandment about this. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Let's not be worshiping Diabolos or Shaitan or anybody else. But what's this one really about? Well, what it's about is having all the kingdoms, all the ruling, all the power of this world in the right hands. Wouldn't it be great if all the power in the world was in the hands of the good guys? Or maybe particularly in the hands of a good guy. Someone we truly trusted. Well, of course it would. That's a great human dream. It's been acted out a bunch of times. You know, one of the primary stories about Alexander the Great, who caused such havoc by trying to live out his dream in the ancient world, was that he saw that the world was just a lot of fighting and wars and everything else, and so his dream was to bring world peace through a single language and a single culture and a single everything, so that people wouldn't have to fight over religion and so forth anymore. But because, you know, he had the dream, he made the world, or he didn't get to fulfill it because he died when he just got started, but his successors, you know, said, well, of course, we'll have Greek religion, and we'll have Greek culture, and we'll have Greek language, and we'll have Greek everything. Everybody will wear letters and go Greek. Which the Jews weren't real happy about, given what it meant for the end of their civilization if that dream was to be fulfilled. But wouldn't it be great if we could have one ruler, peaceful ruler in the world? Yeah, it would be great. The Hebrews dreamt of it too. And the Bible's full of texts that say someday our guy will rule the world. And the whole world will come to Jerusalem for its sustenance, for its wisdom, for its everything. In the intertestamental period, it came to be called the dream of Jerusalem as the navel of the universe. It would be the center of everything. So come on, Jesus. Fulfill the great promise of peace on earth through the benevolent rule of a single God-approved ruler. But the question is, how do you get that power? How do you acquire it? The devil in this story says it's his to give, and Jesus doesn't say it isn't. And it's interesting that in this period, the period of the writing of the New Testament, they believed it was in the hands of the devil. It's what the book of Revelation says, that the authority for ruling the world has been handed over to the great Satan for 1,000 years. Otherwise known as the great whore Babylon. Who was the great Satan? The great whore Babylon in that period? Rome, obviously. Rome kind of had the same idea Alexander the Great did. In a way, they established the Pax Romana. And it was great. The aqueducts that they built and some of the roads are still in use over there. The Pax Romana was wonderful. But you know how it was established? You know how you get that power? You know how the great Satan, the great whore Babylon, does it? Like every other empire, by means of fear, not to mention for the sake of gain. In other words, you do what we say, or we nuke you. That's how Rome ruled. That's Satan's way. That's the devil's way. To rule by means of fear. And maybe for the sake of gain. So all you have to do, Jesus, is admit that my way is the way. And you can have it. You have to be willing to fight to get in position to rule the world. You know, and the people who could have been on the devil's side had a lot of Bible passages to work with. You know, it's no mystery why when the disciples of Jesus went around saying that he had been the Messiah, that people could say, can't be. Because all the messianic promises have not been fulfilled. A, we're still hungry. B, we're still dying. And C, the Romans are still in charge. And the Bible says that when God takes over and the Messiah comes, the Messiah is going to stomp all over the heads of our enemies. The Messiah is going to slaughter all those who are the enemies of God. So just admit it, Jesus. That's the only way to get power, is through conventional means. And you can have it. You can rule the world. So politics of the usual sort is the only way, Jesus. So exercise your power. And Jesus says, nope, I don't worship that idea. I worship the Lord God and serve only God. Well, how does God rule? We have to ask, if this isn't how you do it, based on what Jesus went on to do, how do you do it? What's the alternative to the conventional ways of bringing on the messianic reign? If you don't do it with plenty, and you don't do it with protecting us from all danger, and if you don't do it with world peace, how do you do it? We all know what Jesus did. He went off to die. And he went the way of the cross. He said, if you want to come my way, you take up your cross and you follow me. You save your life by losing it. And we all know that at the end of the story, he becomes the king. He does take over power as ruler of the world, although he's only called King of the Jews at the end. We say that in that story, he's the king of everybody, the ruler of everybody, hanging there crucified as, you know, Christ the King. We have a whole Sunday to celebrate it, that he is our king. My favorite picture of this is actually not in Matthew, but in Luke, where we get everything about human understandings of rule and power turned upside down when Jesus rules as king on Golgotha. And he's hanging there crucified, and this guy next to him says, "Hey, King Jesus, remember me. I want to be your right-hand guy." You know, and just imagine you're one of the soldiers watching this. And here's this conversation of these guys hanging up here on these wood things, you know. And the other guy answers, "Sure, friend, you and me today, paradise, go for it." I mean, just think of that. That's the kingdom that Jesus established. A bunch of crucified guys hanging around saying, "Now what? What do we do next?" As though there is something next. I mean, that's my favorite picture of the church. It's a bunch of crucified people hanging around saying, "Now what?" And believing that there's an answer. It's the power of those who give their lives, not the power of those get power by means of fear and for the sake of gain. And Jesus does go around, as we know, and do some of these things. Jesus does stop a few funerals. You know, he didn't leap off the temple, but he did stop the funeral procession at Nain, and he stopped one mother from grieving over that too early death, and he did interrupt things in the home of Jairus one day. You know, but there were a whole lot of other people dying young in the same territory, and no intervention. You know, what do we make of that? We say, of course, that this is a glimpse of what comes eschatologically. It's a glimpse of end time. It's a proleptic experience, a glimpse of the end time in the meantime. That's our way of explaining why the Messiah didn't fix everything the way the Bible said the Messiah would. Also, we have wonderful stories like the one in Matthew 14, in which Jesus is in a deserted place. and he heals, he feeds 5,000 people, not counting the women and children. I mean, there are lots of little clues here. We're supposed to be remembering wilderness. And Jesus feeds with just a bit of bread and a little bit of meat, and they collect 12 baskets of leftovers. That's the Messianic feast. And if you want to know some other things about what a wonderful feast it is, all you need to do is look at the story that immediately precedes it in Matthew 14. The story immediately before the feeding of the 5,000 in Matthew's Gospel is the story of another wonderful banquet, the one that was held on Herod's birthday, at which they danced. And the dancing was so wonderful that Herod said to his daughter, "I'll give you anything you want." And of course we know what the great dessert ended up being at that banquet: the head of my critic on a platter. Isn't that the banquet most of us really want most in this world? The head of my detractors on a platter. How I would love to see them get their just desserts. But that's not Jesus' banquet. Jesus' banquet is the one where just anybody can show up out in the wilderness and get fed with meager provisions that are enough. And finally, just to show you where this ends up and how we still pray for this today, in Matthew's Gospel, when Jesus teaches people how to pray, in Matthew 6, part of what we pray for is in chapter 6, verse 11 of Matthew. "Give us this day our daily bread," we have learned to pray. And if you have a Bible with footnotes, you may notice that it says there that what the Greek really says isn't "give us today our daily bread." It says, "Give us tomorrow's bread today." As I was saying the other day about the name petition, "Hallowed be your name," this one too has that verb form that asks for God, not asks, demands. It's an imperative. Once and for all, God, do it. Give us tomorrow's bread today. And if we hear that with wilderness ears and with the whole tradition of what all these stories that we've just surveyed, what we're really asking for is the time beyond the wilderness, when we won't have to live just with today's provisions and live solely by faith that tomorrow there will be bread too. We want the end time. We're praying for the ultimate time when God will feed with great abundance. We're praying for the great banquet. But we're also praying, if you listen carefully, we're praying for the day that we don't have to collect. So we're praying for the eternal Sabbath, the day when you don't need to go out and collect bread because you've got tomorrow's bread today. So, a little bit of manna in the wilderness turns into an enormous theme that runs through the whole Bible, and we're still praying for it. And up here in this wilderness, of course, we have it all figured out. We get... That's right. Well, we're going to practice several ways today.
Yeah.
We will do hunger awareness. I guess Thursday is always a good day to talk about food. Yeah. Holden. Thank you very much.